Hi, my name is Michael Corman from the Sound Works Collection, and today I'm excited to talk with the sound team from Michael Mann's new film, Ferrari. Today we have production sound mixer Lee Orloff, CAS, re-recording mixer and supervising sound editor Tony Lamberti, re-recording mixer Andy Nelson, and supervising sound editor Bernard Weiser, MPSC. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
Hello, good day.
Something that I love to bring up when we have opportunities to is not only the shorthand, but the relationship between the sound team and the director. This one is incredibly unique as you guys have a very close and long relationship. Let's just start off with you, Lee. How would you describe your relationship? How far does it go back? And, what has it been like to be on the ride with Michael?
Well, this is a great ride for me. I've always wanted to be part of it. Michael's been talking about this project. I've heard about it since at least as far back as when we did Collateral together. Our first film together was in the mid-90s, early 90s, was Heat. And so, Michael's a Ferrari enthusiast. He owns them and, he loves his cars. And I've seen when he shows up on set with his latest new baby. And besides that, he's always going to be associated with Ferrari through Miami Vice. So, I mean, Ferrari goes very deep into Michael's psyche. And so, I was always crossing my fingers that when this got done, that I would get asked to be part of the team.
My relationship with Michael goes back to about 2014. I worked with him on a movie called Black Hat. And, towards the end of Black Hat, he started revealing the fact that he had been working on Ferrari, and he'd been working on it quite a bit up to that point. And started showing me some of the materials, some of the location scouting, some of the build sheets for the replicas that he was going to be putting together to be able to go through the rigors of production to shoot these things. And, at that point I was hooked in. So, and it would just been, working on a few things here and there throughout the years, and then got fortunate enough to be asked to be on this one.
So I'm like Lee, I go back to the mid-90s with Michael and on Heat, and a few since then, obviously, over the last close to 30 years. He's fascinating to work with. I mean, incredibly detail-oriented, spends a lot of time with us. It's good to work with. I find it great to work with directors repeatedly because you build up the shorthand. And definitely with him, it's been a huge advantage to have that. I think when I read this script, I knew this was going to be something special. And sure enough, when it turned up cut on the screen, I was just delighted by it. So, another great trip down, that sort of work with Michael next to us is always fun.
I'm like Tony. We started working with him in 2014 with Black Hat. And I have a long relationship with Tony. We've worked together on numerous films before that. So again, chemistry and people work together for a long time on all levels really produces good results.
That's awesome. It's something that I love about this film is it drops you in right, in the summer of 1957. The film set up with this the opening of this black and white footage, kind of giving some backstory on Enzo and his lineage. What did you guys maybe think going into this film that was going to happen? And then now that, you've gone through it and you kind of see where Michael was headed, what surprised you? What was exciting and unexpected about where this story kind of takes audiences?
Well, for me, it was, the fact that it was such a short little snippet of what was going on with Enzo over the course of his long life, but a very pivotal moment in his life. And so the fact that Michael chose to take this moment in time when all this kind of turmoil was happening between him and his wife and the company and his mistress it was just amazing how much everything that was going on at that point in time. So that was kind of the initial wow, so much happened in such a short amount of time. It's pretty amazing.
This is definitely in Michael's wheelhouse. If I look back to Ali and Insider, both of those were similar in that they're snippets of a period of time in the protagonist's life that were transformative. And so you just see, you know, when you read the script, you realize Michael's found this window that would basically explain and be able to portray to the audience all the aspects of the character, but within this very heightened, supercharged event or moment in his life. I mean, the way we open, getting out of the opening period piece, and then we start off in the scene where we see Enzo arrive at his house with Laura, waiting, hearing him come in, and the scene in the bedroom. I'm not sure how much we could talk about that scene, but it is wonderful. I'll talk about a character of, you just want to see more of Laura after you leave that bedroom, because it's a very dramatic and wonderful comedic. But I mean, it really sets the tone for the movie.
It sets the tone. And I think what's great is it's not, you think of biopics, they're very hard to do. This is not a biopic in any way whatsoever. It's just a small period of a moment in time in the late 50s in Modena. And but there's so much going on. That's the essence of it. The story is so rich with, as Lee said, all these different things happening in his life. But it's dropping you into that character. You learn very quickly, what is going on and exactly how the scene is set and the place. It captures the feel of the town beautifully. And you learn very quickly. And I think that was such a lovely, appealing part of this story, was that we weren't trying to tell a story of a man's life. This is just a period of time, a very important period of time.
For you, Tony, knowing that when Lee goes off onto set, that there's a kind of a tall order of capturing a wide range of different types of engines, Maseratis, the Ferraris, all the different types of models and engine sizes. What crosses your mind just knowing what Michael is asking of the sound team?
Well, initially I knew the amount that was going to needed to be recorded post shoot, because Michael had shown me the build sheets back in 2015 saying, these are the cars I'm going to be building. So I already had it in my mind, we're going to have a handful of cars that we're going to actually need to go out and shoot in the field. And so, I enlisted a couple of great field recordists, John Fasol. I got him on board early on when we started chasing down cars, both here in the United States and in the UK. Knowing that, some of the cars that Michael had shot, specifically the very first one that we see, which is the Maserati 250F, that the guys are testing in the track, which is the intercut in the church scene. We were going to have to record that one from the Nick Mason collection, because that's actually Nick Mason's car. Nick Mason being the drummer of Pink Floyd, who loaned Michael his car for the shoot. That's the only car that's doing hardcore racing that's not a replica car. So we knew we were going to have to get that one. And then the other ones, when you're trying to convince, collectors and museums to take their cars that are worth millions, sometimes worth tens of millions of dollars, and go out and really race them hard, it's a very daunting task, because they start questioning what your motives are. Why do you need to do this? And so one thing led to another, and we were super fortunate that Holly Mason, who runs – who's the daughter of Nick Mason, who runs the collection, ended up helping us wrangle all the cars that we needed. And so, we had some cars here in the UK, in the US we were going to get, but it just worked out that the UK was better, and it worked out. And we ended up getting that, the Maserati. We ended up getting a Ferrari Lancia D50, which is stand-in for the Ferrari 801. And then also a 1953 Mille Miglia car, which is stand-in for the 315 Ferraris at the end during the big Mille Miglia race. So, and it was fantastic. We worked with recordist by the name of Chris Jojo, who had been employed by the collection to record Nick Mason's 250 GTO the year before. And he did a fantastic job, and it worked out amazing. Michael was so happy. When we started getting the real cars in to the track, he was just like, I can't believe how this is transforming what I'm hearing. So it was really great to be able to do that.
Just add to that, from the standpoint of production, from from the beginning, I knew what Michael's design was for it, that any car that was going to appear on the soundtrack was going to be authentic. It was going to be one of the rare period cars that are so hard to find, but that's all that would ever make it to the audience. So what we had on set were ground up builds that were done in the UK with basically Maserati four cylinder turbos. So my job was to make sure that what I delivered to post was, you know, so that I could reduce the effect of that into the dialogue tracks to the point where we could pull it out enough to then lay the authentic sounds on top of it. So it became something all the time because cars come and go over dialogue. You know, you've got scenes in the pit, and all of those are replica cars, none of which sound correct. So that's one of the challenges. And from what I've heard from everyone here in the room is that they were able to work the magic.
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't have worked out better. I mean, Lee did such an amazing job in terms of setting us up for that eventuality, you know, to being able to get all that production car sound out and replacing it with the beautiful, glorious vintage car sounds, which, you know, it's its own mechanical music, you know. So, and it couldn't have worked out better. It was, you know.
And some directors, you know, I can have these conversations and we could try to turn cars on and off. We could have grips push them in. You know, that just doesn't work in Michael's world. Everything's dynamic. So if you've got cars coming and going, they're running all the time.
What I really like, and especially how Michael uses camera, is playing perspective. Sometimes there's plenty of on the car, looking at engines, bird's eye, using just all the techniques, all the tools he has at his disposal to kind of show the audience all the variations of perspective. But sometimes it's just a locked off shot and you have the cars just kind of in the distance. And to me, that really shows his trust of the audience knows we're at a race. But for you guys, it's like, now we have to really sell what's happening off screen. So Lee, how much of that is you're aware of on when you're on location?
I don't like to dumb it down and say we're dogs on a leash, but basically the camera is king. And that perspective is what defines everything that we do in terms of perspective. And in the modern world, it's not just one camera perspective. So you have to kind of roll the dice and say, okay, we're shooting three, but which one is he more likely to use? So make sure you deliver that mix, because that's the modern world of filmmaking. There's no single, you know, no one's cutting on set in the camera anymore.
The thing is, Lee, I think what's impressive is the construction of the film that Michael and Pietro did, which allows for these, when you cut to a racing sequence, you really cut to the sequence. You don't suddenly dip the soundtrack down to reveal some voiceover or dialogue or whatever it might be traditionally in those types of scenes. He just plays them full out. And I think from that point of view, it gave us tremendous leeway to just have a lot of fun with it, including with the music, which of course was another component. We weren't, you know, how do we put music? The car engines are music. There's nothing more musical than the sound of these cars. So Daniel Pemberton had a really tough job to put this all together musically, and he did a wonderful job. But we had to pick our way through those because the scenes had to be very dynamic and very strong. And that was very much down to the way the film was directed and cut before we got our hands on it, really.
And it's in the script. You know, the drama of the cut, the dynamic aspect of being in these very tight, you know, environments, the interior of Enzo's house, all that domestic drama that's going on, everything interior is very lean and very contained. And then, you know, smash cut to the sound of the V12 at full revs, you know, and the tires, you know, it's just wonderful. And it's right there in the script. So you knew reading it that it was going to play that way.
It is in the script, Lee, but how often does the script make its way to the final cut? In this case, it made its way. And that was what was
great. And that was the dramatic, real dramatic effect that Michael was going for the whole time was, you know, the juxtaposition of those two things, you know, of the tight family drama, these intense scenes that then just go to the brutal racing, and it's something he loved it every time we would go across these cuts. from going from one to the other, he'd just be like, that's, you know, he'd just be smiling. It's fantastic. So, and speaking really quickly of the off-camera stuff. So one of the things that Michael and I did early on was we went through the entire movie and all the race scenes and spotted all the stuff that's even happening off camera. So in terms of the racecraft of the movie, you know, things are happening with the car when Enzo and DiPartago are having a discussion, say, and the testing is going on off camera. All that stuff was completely mapped out by Michael, myself, and Robert Nagel, who is the Michael's longtime stunt coordinator. And we were like, okay, it's going to be a downshift here, and then he's going to accelerate there. And then, you know, so we had mapped it all out so that when the real recordings came in, we were able to just plug them in and have it, you know, sculpted the way Michael intended.
One of the sequences, which I want to take a few moments to talk about, is this church service with our first race sequence, really. We're being introduced to the racetrack, we're being introduced to the cars. And to me, the notes I wrote down was like, there's a balance of the car and the choir and the priest. And then there's this introduction of the clicking of the stopwatches. And there's a weight that is basically felt for me as an audience member of hearing but feeling the cars. Are you okay?
Hoc est enim corpus meum.
God be with you. Now go in peace.
In nomine Patris, Filii, et Spiritus Sancti. Amen.
Very good. Okay. Great. 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 Very, very good.
Maybe Lee, start off. What was that church sequence like? Because I think we can't really control churches. So what did you find with your approach?
Again, Michael, you know, always looking as far back as I go with him. When we're shooting something on Insider, we go back to the courtroom in Pascagoula, Mississippi. We're in that church because that's the right church to be in. That's where the workers would show up for mass. So, you know, all these things are, they're baked into Michael's whole way of conceiving of the film. You know, because emotionally, he knows that it's different when it's real. So, you know, so we have that environment. Like I say, it's a great environment because you have that, the piety of the situation. At the same time, everyone knows that no one's really paying attention to what the priest is saying because they hear the gunshots and they know that there's a, so it's also Michael commenting on how committed they are to their work. The priest even brings it up in the sermon. He talks about, you know, that this is holy work that you're doing. This is the modern day carpenters, you know. It's a beautiful scene. And then, you know, I'll hand it off to you guys, because the way it was handled in terms of the timing that Pietro set up in terms of the stopwatch, how you built to that point, it's wonderful.
I'll jump in real quick. Bernard, what is it like knowing that you're cutting between a racetrack with high dynamics of engines and dialogue is cutting through both on the racetrack and in this church sequence? Yeah. So let's start with dialogue.
Yeah, that's an exciting part of this. When you're talking about what attracted us and what were the challenges, the design of that fact was excited all of us. And certainly Tony and I, we discussed about the juxtaposition of these highly dramatic scenes where we knew the backgrounds are going to be almost non-existent. It's just the dialogue, which is the challenge for all of us on the dialogue side and the editors. You have to have very clean tracks because it's going to be exposed. There's nothing to hide behind. But it's exciting to have that type of drama protecting the performance like that to slam into the violence of the racing and have that hit you right in your face. And it's, of course, from a sound design point of view, that's exciting. And again, it started in the script. We were all on the same page with what we wanted out of that. And good things happened that way. I wanted to mention also, though, intercutting is like the church scene that Lee was talking about. And this is kudos to Lee, is understanding that environment had to be so consistent. You know, you have a wide shot, you have a close-up, you have medium shots, you're moving around, but it had to be mic'd where those are going to cut together and be consistent. Otherwise, it just creates a cavalcade of problems. Lee was aware of that all up and down, and his professionalism kept that nice and consistent and allowed the scene to play and allowed the performance to come out.
The experience shows up when you need it most. It seems that there's a shorthand with this team and you guys understand what the goal is to serve Michael and his film. But at the end of the day, in the back of your mind, like what Lee's saying, you understand camera maybe might take precedent over sound sometimes, but I feel like you guys have figured out a way to kind of make sound just obviously, because when sound does not meet expectations for an audience and the audience is fighting the sound, that we've created more problems than what picture could ever do when we have bad sound. So maybe Andy and Tony, can you guys describe just mixing the sequence? Because I feel like what you guys are doing in terms of spatially and just sonically, it's really incredible.
Once we go to the exterior and we hear the Maserati, as the Maserati takes off, then the Mozart starts to come in. And that becomes the kind of glue between the sequences. So from that point of view, then everything has to sort of fall into a pattern just naturally. The thing that we had fun with, I remember, Tony, particularly when we got to the stopwatches, there was, there's a close-up of one or two, and we kind of played around by saying, well, the story now is about, this isn't about one or two people monitoring the time trial that's going on with Maserati. The whole church is doing that. Yeah. So we added, I think, Tony, you added about 20 more stopwatches.
Yeah, exactly. On camera.
But the whole point was that was telling the story at that point in time. So you've now got the three elements. You've got the car going, you've got the Mozart, you've got stopwatches, you've got the priest's voice. It was just a dance we did. And I think it just fell together. It wasn't a struggle to do because it was cut and conceived so well. And often with sound, we find that, you know, the sequences we struggle over, there's a reason for that. When something's put together so beautifully, there's a flow to it that happens. And I think we all felt really, really good about that scene.
Yeah, that one came together very, very nicely. And just to put a button on it, you know, when the Maserati, when we finally got the recordings in, you know, we realized that, you know, there was so much power in these recordings. Andy and I commented on it multiple times, is we didn't really need to play it super, super loud. It just conveyed a sense of power, even when you didn't really play it super loud. And just all the action that it was doing and the action that Michael had cut. And then once we got the stopwatches in, and then we tried different, you know, we tried perspectivizing the close-ups of the stopwatches and then not having them. But once we just decided to just let the stopwatches go and just rip, it was great, because then it just came all, you know, it just heightened the whole scene and made it all about time. And it's like, you know, the time is the important thing here. So, it's one of my favorite sequences in the movie.
A little thing to add to point out is all this, just, it didn't like fall into place by itself. This kind of came out of communication all of us were communicating. This is true of the overall film as well. I was in touch with Lee early on. Andy came in to see an early cut of it. We were around. We got to hear those discussions at that point. So we all had input to what was going on. Of course, Michael's listening to this and then following his direction, what he liked out of it. But communication of all of our crafts together includes Pietro. I was embedded with them when I came on with the picture department. So all of this was constant communication that would flow. And this is what happens from a lot of hard work and communication.
That's great. One of the kind of small scenes that I really liked was when we visit the Ferrari factory, like the assembly where they're building engines. And to me, you know, this film takes place in a wide variety of rooms. Lee, what did you find when we get to the factory and we get to kind of where, you know, when we start to see where the sausage is made? What was it? Where are those locations? Like, how are they built? Were those all? How do they come about figuring out those locations? And then obviously that whole, you know, the different conference rooms and the different spaces that the company has. How did you find it was to be on location there?
You know, I said earlier, Michael never builds sets. Everything is practical, but he sometimes will take an existing building and then build sets within it. So the factory was on a very busy state road, just on the outskirts of the heart of Modena, just outside the historical area. And so basically what was there, the bones of it were there, but then we added an entire other section of rooms, which was basically Enzo's office, the hallway leading up to it. And then we also created sets that were around the courtyard where the cars would come in. The entrance of the building was a facade that was built so that the cars could come in through that opening. So, you know, the challenges are we're in 2022 Modena, and we've got mopeds and we've got high revving, you know, all of that stuff that's incorrect for the period that has to be kept off the track. So it's my standard drill, which is trying to, again, get control of those elements so that I can deliver clean, you know, as Bernard was saying, and Andy as well, is that the tracks play very lean and spare. So you want to make sure that all that stuff is gone as much as you can from production so you don't have to spend creative time fixing things that are, you know, manageable on set.
Well, with that being said, I'd love to ask, what do you do when we have a scene like the rainstorm basically comes through and they're outside in umbrellas having these really kind of important conversations in these moments? How did you guys know, you know, what is going to work, what's not going to work? Because I feel like that scene to me, it's a very pivotal moment in kind of where the story is going to go. And yet they're under umbrellas, they're outside, the cars are going to be driving in these conditions. Yeah.
Well, just that sequence regarding rain started with the big 5-page scene in Enzo's office, where it was conceived for them to be looking out the window and there'd be sheets of water coming down for that deluge. And as I said, that set was a built set. So basically it's like a cardboard box with you know, Visqueen on top. So as soon as they brought the pumpers in, and, you know, I saw what the position was. As soon as I got the set that morning, I went to the producer and I said, we have to have a talk. I said, this is a pivotal scene. This is the scene that explains to the audience what Enzo has to do to save the company. We cannot play this with a pumper, which is 100 feet away, with, you know, a plastic roof on this thing and a cardboard set. And so I, you know, that was hard to convey to Michael. And so I asked him, can we do a rehearsal with the rain on? And that was so telling that I got my way. And we wound up using it with the effects department, basically wetting the windows. And Eric, you know, got some lighting effects so we could get a little bit of that sense on their face that there was rain outside. But yeah, that's one of those things where you just stick your neck out on the chopping block and you hope that you get called back for the next one.
Well, I'd also say you're probably more comfortable doing that because of your relationship with Michael and he understands. I don't think Lee would be saying this unless he actually, you know, is kind of concerned, right? I mean,
well, this is a thing that goes on a lot with production in general now, is that there's not, because I come back from a ways back, we used to have a voice on the set, and that voice has been stifled to the point where very few production mixers are willing to step up and ruffle the feathers that are necessary to control the set sometimes, because it's just such a behemoth of, you know, this thing, the train has left the station and there's three cameras and there's hundreds of people. And now the sound department needs this, you know, it's just the energy has changed. I come from a time when it wasn't that unusual for the production mixer to speak up.
Yeah, I think the thing is, well, I tell you what's interesting, Lee, is of course, when it gets to us, there isn't a director in the world that actually wants to have to put ADR in. So they'll do anything they can to make those tracks work. And that's obviously a huge challenge sometimes, because as you say, the work that you're under, the constraints that you're under sometimes on the set are so tricky that the director will say, oh, we'll deal with it later, but they don't want to deal with it later, really.
Right. I'm trying to convey to them that I'm not doing this for the sound department. I'm doing it for the movie. This is really what you want to do, but right now you've lost focus on it. And I'm trying to keep your focus on the fact that it's part of the circle. And if the first part has got chinks in the armor, it's going to hurt everybody down the road.
John, I want to chime in with that scene, especially outside when we're next to the car and we're in the rain. And of course, from a dialogue post and editorial perspective, it's where you take a deep breath before you dive into that, because it happens all the time. And it's very common that very little is done to really help you get clean dialogue in those scenes. Lee did something that from the post side, we say all the time, is rarely heard because it's usually after the fact and nobody remembers us saying it, is to do a take without the machines on, a wild track, especially in today's day and age where we can manipulate and put so many things into sync. Why not do that? And so few people did. Lee did that in the key part of the scene. You know, things are changing all the time. So we didn't have the entire scene, but the key dialogue, absolutely. And that's the track we used. So you could hear it. And then we placed the rain back on top. And the rest of it is technology really helps to pull that down, to make it not as harsh and make it part of the scene. But the key of it was those wild tracks that really helped a lot post-wise to make that work. And thank you, Lee, for doing that, because it's teach more people to do that.
It's another thing talking about the historic sets. We always used to do wild tracks. We used to do room tone. We don't do room tone. You know, so all these things have changed the way the set runs. So when you say wild track, the first assistant director looks at you like you've spoken crack. I mean, we don't do, who does that? Nobody does that, you know, but that's it. That scene, the only way, I mean, it's your only stab at it is there in the moment. It's an ensemble piece. The actors have their characters defined. Just do another one for us. It's one ask.
Yeah, always the big challenge of ADR is you're asking actors to come in to a recording stage months after they've done the scene and recall spot on the emotions and performance of that scene. It is always a big, big ask. And very tough to do. Sometimes we have some actors that can do it spot on every single time, others that wrestle with it. But to get it, the wild track right after they do the scene is by far the best time to do it.
I want to go back in time and whoever said fix it in post, just to like kind of just be like, push them off a cliff. Like the idea of fixing it in post, like nothing should be fixed. We can salvage, we could make the best use of what we're given, obviously. But I'm really happy to hear that, Lee, that you kind of, I wouldn't say you even stuck your neck out. I would just say you're doing your job, right? Like this is what you're being asked to do. Oh, maybe we should turn off this really loud noise.
It is. It's part of what you're expected to do. You're supposed to give, you know, you're supposed to give editorial, the film, the best chance of success. And anything you step back from and say, oh, well, okay, you throw in the towel, reduces the chance of that working as well as it could. And it forces, again, hours to be spent on technical fixes as opposed to creative solutions.
That's fantastic. One of the scenes that we have another clip for is this opera scene, which to me is sonically very dynamic. It's very expansive. It's a wonderful use of, I think, of Atmos. We're playing with some close-up. Once again, Michael puts the camera right there in the actors' faces, and he's doing that with these singers on stage. And then we have this lovely flashback, and we hard cut to a racetrack.
Oh. Deor sia panni, compenso avrai la tua salute, rifiorirà. Sospiro e luce, tu mi sarai tutto il futuro. Ne arriverà.
Parigi, o cara, noi lasceremo la vita uniti, trascorreremo.
Maybe Andy, talk about what were the tracks that you were given for the, you know, with the opera scene, and how did you guys start to fill it out into the room?
The vocals were recorded live by Lee, and the orchestra was a pre-recorded track, of course. So it was about telling the story, to be honest with you, because the we start the opera and we're very off stage. And we just wanted to have that sound drift through. We cut inside to the opera house itself, and we're in the full ambience of the opera. But the point of the scene, dramatically, wasn't about being in that venue. It was about what's being conveyed at that moment in time. So once we go on stage, the decision that Michael had made early on when he was cutting the piece was to go into a much more intimate moment. So at that point, we just dried up the sound, the acoustic, a lot, and went very, very much as if we were right on stage with our singers, which indeed the camera was. But the purpose of that really was then when you cut to the flashback, you cut to the audience, you cut to them watching, sitting, looking, they were all reflective about what this song meant to them, what this aria meant. To each individual person, they were all experiencing it in a different way. And I think that suddenly it became a very different piece. It wasn't about them attending a performance. It was about them looking back into their own lives and reflective and looking forward into the dangers that the drivers faced and things like that. So I think that's why the sequence has so much power, so much emotional power.
I wanted to add, because I worked quite a bit on that one specific scene, and early on there, that was the advantage of working with Pietro directly, because we were in and out of each other's rooms talking about the little transitions involved with that scene and getting the original splits. I spoke with Lee about that to make sure we had everything we needed. Michael had made his choices of which pieces he wanted and how he wanted it to flow. Then it was for me to make sure it was so vital that it had to float, because it was all about the emotion and a little bit of backstory, but emotional backstory is what's in it. And it had to float and be in the right space for it. So the tracks being in the right position in a way that Andy could continue and mix that was vital. And we played with it. There was little defects here and there. I'd speak with Lee about it. He'd know exactly what it was from remembering the recordings. And we'd smooth that all out and got that balance to make sure it flowed. So the positioning of those live tracks, that early on, you have the acoustics of the ambience of that perspective. And then there's a moment where we come onto stage and we go right into those live tracks from then on. And that's what's kind of like that acceleration into that emotional state.
Regarding the live recording of the tenor and the soprano, one of the things that Bernard was talking about is as soon as I did it, I made notes in my report, there's a head turn at this point, because we're basically on stage with the two of them in each other's arms, but there's hard theatrical lighting with a hard spot. So I'm doing this on boom because it yielded a much better result than the lavs. And so it because it also had some of the space that we would lose on the lav. So I'm putting that forth as this is my concept. I'm going to live or die by it. And there's this head turn, and I knew that was going to be the take. First of all, we only did two takes, because that's the reason we went through this whole thing, is when you're shooting something like opera live, they're like Olympic athletes. They get themselves ready. They warm their voice up. They're ready. When they're good to go, they're good to go once, maybe twice, but you don't do it like a film where you have them do it 8-10 times. So that's where all the pre-records for all the wide shots, everything onto the audience, all that stuff was pre-record mixes that we did. So we didn't have to wear them out until we're right there on stage, like you say, right in their medium and tight shots. So, it's funny that you bring that up, Bernard, because I know I'm saying it and I know the issue. It's, that head turn.
Well, a challenge with it is that with opera, it's different. It's not like you go back later on, they would go back into a studio, they sing their parts. I mean, that's the normal way with music that you're going to do that, to have a nice, clean track. But in opera, the music follows the performance. So you don't have, it's not... You can't go from one take to another all the time and place that in. Musically, you'll get into a problem. So it's a different approach, a different mindset on how that's going to edit. You have to pick those spots where you can cross over maybe into a different take and do what Pietro did. It's a fine hand on all levels, all the way through. Because again, the music is actually following the performance.
Not only in the edit, but also in performance, because these performers are never used to doing what we're asking them to do, to put earwigs in their ears, to hear the orchestra playing with them, but canned so that it's not responsive. So they have to, dealt with this before the day, way before we would get them on the stage with the camera in front of them, to get them to be comfortable with something that's completely foreign to them.
So what I'm understanding is there's no click track. That's what you're saying, Lee.
free ball, we like to say.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, I can't imagine. When you know that you're being what the pages are in the script, and you know what the environment is, you know what Michael's going to do with this scene and how it's going to play out. To me, it's just a masterclass and just what is possible when picture and sound and the director are all cohesive in the vision. So yeah, kudos to you guys for pulling it off, because it feels, as an audience member, it feels very effortless, which is what you want. We don't want to be pulled out, but sonically there's so much going on that it's really great to hear that backstory. So yeah, thank you guys for sharing that. This film is kind of the backbone of this film is this race, this 1,000-mile race across Italy. We know we're going to get there as an audience, and we want to get there. But can you guys just talk about the buildup? There's a few kind of moments to me, which I really love. One of them is even just this in the garage, we have like pigeons in the building, and we hear pigeons up in the corner. And then later on, as we get to the big race day, with the introduction of the cars entering the track, and I feel like the interaction between Enzo and his drivers, those little kind of nuance, like he's feeding them, like, think of this, think of that, like, I know what we need. It's like really important dialogue, and yet it still works with a full crowd going and with these engines revving. So yeah, talk to me about just the setup of this big race.
Before we get to the Mille Miglia race, you know, there's the fallout from the French Grand Prix, which, Enzo's very upset because the drivers didn't perform, you know, to the best of their ability. Maserati gets one over on them. And that's true to life what happened that year in racing. The Maserati team was the better team. They had the amazing drivers. They had Stirling Moss. They had John Barra. They had, you know, the best of the best. They had Juan Manuel Fangio, who used to drive for Ferrari. And then Ferrari had his team. And his team were all very good drivers. Some of them were world champions. But they weren't quite up to the same level. So he has a little dressing down of them, so to speak. After that, and which is an amazing scene, and Adam did an amazing job, and Andy took that production dialogue and just made it so intense in terms of, you know, every little, you know, movement of Adam and everything that he does in that. You're just like, oh my God, I can't believe he's taking these guys down. And then that sets up, you know, the getting us to the Mille Miglia. And, you know, you see the drivers as they're preparing the night before, and they're going through, they're writing their letters to their loved ones, as they did every time, because they weren't sure what was going to happen, if they were going to make it back. And so, and then once we hit the starting block, for me, that's where the whole third act takes off, and just unbelievable in terms of how Michael staged that, and, you know, Enzo giving the directions to each different driver. He's giving different things to Di Bartago as he did. To the rest of the drivers, so Collins and whoever else, I forget who else he was addressing at the time, but and then we're off, and then in true Michael Mann fashion, we're in this amazing race, and the, you know, the vistas of the mountains and the different cities for the pit stops, and it just, you know, it's just incredible how he staged it.
That was a tough scene. The ramp was a tough scene to mix because there is so much going on. But ultimately, you know, every time we were in a close-up, as Tony said, Enzo would give them all a little pep talk before each driver took off. And it was just about the clarity of that. What was interesting about that scene was, you know, at the end of the scene, once his last driver's taken off, Enzo turns around. And, you know, he's got so much else going on in his life, and you go inside him. It goes very quiet as he just walks away because he knows what those guys are about to face. But at the same time, he's trying to face his own problems domestically. And so it's kind of a really interesting moment where he's done this fantastic rah-rah speech, and then he just goes right inside his head as he leaves the place and goes to carry on with, you know, what he has to deal with. So it was a tough sequence to do that. You got the cheering crowds, you got the revving engines and the takeoffs and the intimate dialogue. But we spent a bit of time on that sequence, I think, right, Tony?
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely one of the ones we spent quite a bit of time on.
There's a lot of stacking of engines and dynamics, and like the engines are building, but we never quite max out. What have you guys found in terms of, especially with this whole race sequence, what was effective in trying to have character, sonic characters between the Maseratis and the Ferraris, and just the quantity of cars that is being shown at one time?
Well, I think, you know, one of the real keys was that Michael, in the cutting of it with Pietro, really focused on, took the camera and really focused on what he wanted to focus on. So if we're in the cockpit with Di Bartago, especially in that duel with John Barra, you know, we're with Di Bartago. So we're playing primarily Di Bartago, even though we know we're in two or three or four cars around us, we're there. So we kind of, you know, we just follow around where the camera's moving to. And then when they're side by side, we split them across the screen. We pan them hard left or hard right so that we can clear a little space. John Barra is driving Maserati, which has a big throaty V8 engine, and Di Bartago has the V12. So two kind of more distinctive type sounds, fortunately enough, that we were able to have during that duel. And then, you know, it's just kind of carving it around to be dynamic and ups and downs, to like feature one over the other a little bit to get them to read through.
The stereo positioning helped a lot, Tony, I think, in terms of identifying. And going back to the Atmos of this all, I mean, Tony and I were very conscious to not make this film a sort of elitist in an Atmos mode. This film has to stand up and play just as beautifully in 7.1, 5.1, which is, you know, truly what a lot of people will see it in because of the number of theaters. But so we were very cautious to make sure that we weren't making decisions that wouldn't sound so good in a lesser format. We mixed a lot of time in the lesser format to make sure that everything came through true. And that was where a lot of time was spent, I think, particularly positioning the cars, as you said, Tony.
Lee, knowing that, you know, I don't know how many pages it is, how many minutes this race sequence is, but there are pivotal moments of dialogue, interchanging, calling out directions. How did you guys capture this stuff? Because I feel like the camera is on the back of a car racing after these race cars, and the camera, how the pacing of the edit also is, but we have clear dialogue of the audience and we hear it. We're able to track it. So yeah, how do you manage dialogue on even when a fast paced scene like this?
Well, in the same way that, you know, was always the edict from the beginning, in terms of what microphones to use that would be able to reduce the effect of the inaccurate motors, you know, in those situations, if you look at the performances, and I can tell you how many times I've asked a director to ask his cast to speak up, and he looks at me like I'm, you know, coming from another planet, they spoke up. Okay, so they are in the moment where the performance that the audience is hearing is accurate in terms of they're playing as if they're talking over the sound of big, powerful, throaty engines. So that part in terms of dynamics was handled that way, and it was there, you know, baked in. And when it comes to anything that's actual recorded dialogue that takes place within cars that are on the track, then, you know, you use the techniques that you do for all the running shots we do now. If you can get within RF range, you do it that way. You embed recorders in there so that you've got a backup for the tracks that you might get hits on that don't make it into the follow van. When you're working at those speeds, a lot of times follow vans and those types of things are impractical. So you wind up with the embedded recorders as your principal choice, because you know that's going to bring home the money.
Yeah, there's also a lot of takes. A lot of those scenes, he would do 8 to 12 takes, knowing that just, you know, by random, there could be sounds coming over that's going to stomp on certain pieces of dialogue. So by doing multiple takes that way, there was choices to be made, a lot of choices to be made to get the right piece at the right time.
And Michael also tweaks so take one of Michael's camera angle is not take five. Everything is a slight adjustment, you know, and that's the way, you know, I'm used to working with Michael over the years, and whether it's a close up, I kind of think of all these scenes being shot like masters, because they're all very, you never know what part of it he's going to use. And he does tend to, when even if they're smaller clips, he tends to put big handles on it. So there's longer pieces than a lot of other directors might go in for the special moment. Michael is not a kind of generally a special moment kind of director. He likes the bigger whole pieces to choose from.
You know, also he's a director that understands this one concept, which is you're picking out the best picture, and then you go back through to listen to all those takes to pick out the best performance in sound and make sure you have the staff that's going to marry that together. So you have the best track and the best picture. It's not necessarily that exact take that matches that picture. Oftentimes it's a different take. The sound take is different from the picture. Then you have to make it work, because he's going for the best performance on all levels. And he really understands that you have that flexibility to bring out your story.
So that's why if I'm asking for a wild track, Michael and the first AD is staring me down, Michael will just say, no, give it to Lee. Let's do it. Because he thinks of them, he wants to have multiple options, as many options as possible.
I see t-shirt opportunities that just say, give it to Lee on the back. That's what I hear. Give us our wild tries. Give us our room tone. Give us all these things that, oh, maybe do show up on, you know, in the editorial and on the mixing stage. You know, my last question for you all is, you know, after so many pictures with Michael, What do you, he has such a visual, his thumbprint is all over every department in a really good way, because it's his voice as a director. But what my question is, what did you take away from this film that was maybe different from another, you know, film that you've done with Michael? And what do you just appreciate about that collaboration, you know, with Michael? I find, you know, there's a reason that directors keep their crews around, is because everyone, it's a team sport. And I think he wants you guys, you know, in his corner. So yeah, maybe let's start with Tony. What is it about working on Michael's films? And
well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you nailed it, Michael. It's, you know, his DNA is throughout every single department in this movie, and from the music to the picture to the sound to everything. And so for me, you know, I knew it was going to be going in for authenticity. Sake, you know, as he always does. He researches his subjects and does, you know, knows his everything that he's doing inside and out. But this one, I think, went to a whole nother level for me in terms of that, and what we went through every single frame to make sure the cars were exactly what we wanted them to be. And so, you know, when we went out to, and then the recording of them, you know, I spent multiple weekends working with the sound recordist, going over mic setups and you know, giving him all the details of exactly what we wanted the cars to perform and the drivers to do. And so for me, you know, I had never, it had been quite a while since I'd gone to that level of detail and then really strive to really push myself to deliver the tracks that, you know, that we ended up coming up with. You know, we're super, super fortunate to have, you know, a great team of other people trying to help wrangle the cars and record them and drive them and do all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, you know, it's Michael that's making all those decisions, and he wants it to be this way. And you know, everybody pushing to get it to that level.
Andy, what's your takeaway?
I think, as Bernard said, I saw the picture, the cut of the film, obviously, before we started working on it. And I knew it was in really good shape. I mean, you know, there's times when you watch something and you know there's still some more work to be done. I just felt this one was had come together really well. So that was a huge plus. We didn't have a tremendous amount of time to work on this. It was one of the tighter schedules we've done with Michael, which initially worried me. But actually, you know, he was so focused and so aware of that we did make decisions in a pretty timely fashion. He, you know, I've worked with a lot of different directors over the years. I respond to strong directors. I've always preferred that. And there isn't anybody stronger than Michael. And he, you know, he gives us latitude, but he's definitely going to get his movie the way he wants it. And I like that. I enjoy working in that way. So, there was nothing particularly new other than I knew this picture was in really good shape. And that was a huge plus.
That's awesome. Bernard, what's your take?
Yeah, I got to add to that is, as a supervisor, I mean, we key into, especially a strong director, when they're talking about their film, we're keying into how they portray their film. Because we need to interpret emotionally what's vested, what's lighter, to provide the sound that's going to support that story. That storyline and what the director wants. So the stronger the director, the more we have to latch onto and do what we do professionally. But being embedded with them in the picture department was really, really important to deal with all the accents and work closely with Pietro was really, really important to balance that out. Michael wants to economize his time, yet he's going to be very detailed. So a lot of work that would be done as we get to the stage and listening to dialogue saying, I'd really rather have something different here, that was already done. Because I would, an example, early ADR, I would take that, we'd zone down to the takes that Michael wanted, and I would actually pre-mix that in. I'd always provide the original track, but an actually pre-mixed ADR piece to be put into his Avid tracks. So Michael could hear the potential and how that's going to sound. And that would allow Andy to know also the direction that Michael likes and make it even better. So that process helped a lot because Michael could zone in quicker on where things were going, how well they were working or maybe not. With all the challenges, they certainly happen. And And it gives me the opportunity to talk about an important thing that Michael brought up the day I started, was the clarity of the tracks. You're dealing with a lot of accents. You have Italian actors speaking English, but they have a heavy Italian accent. And quite frankly, some of them were very difficult to understand. So that caused some very precise editing, which, by the way, Michael loves that. He loves dialogue people to get in and really manipulate those tracks. But the key is there's only so far you can manipulate before it sounds manipulated. So the integrity of the track, the integrity of the performance was absolutely vital, all the more so on this show because the level of those performances was through the roof. All award level performances. Adam, what he did, all the work he does to get that right, the pacing, speaking English with an Italian pacing. He had trained himself to do that, and he really pulls that off, and it makes you believe he's Italian, even though he's speaking English. Penelope, it's almost a natural thing for her. I can't say enough about her and her professionalism, the way she approaches the craft. Obviously, Spanish. She's fluent in Italian as well, so she knew that accent. So she was by far the easiest. But then there's the other side, too, the Italian actors. The gentleman who plays Quoggy, very heavy accent, posed a lot of challenges there. And it got down to taking a syllable and sometimes moving it a few frames within the word. You're using his same performance, but all of a sudden you've gained that clarity. That was so important. Literally, there was some sequences where you just didn't understand what was going on. So minimizing the ADR was important to do that. But then again, with him, his session is an example of it, is the challenges one has. We finally tracked him down. He was very busy in Copenhagen. So his session was in Copenhagen. We come online. We're about to start the session. Their internet took a dive completely. Couldn't communicate, couldn't get the session through. And now we're all dependent on these remote sessions on the internet to make it all work. So we quickly kind of backtracked and either we canceled the session, reschedule it, which was tight on the schedules that we had. So we did a phone patch and did this whole thing with the phone systems to make it work for Michael and recorded the ADR. But, you know, every film has these challenges and it's how quick you can figure out how to do it. Michael's very intense with getting things done. You'd think that'd be a huge problem for somebody like him, where actually he's very adaptable. He's very actor oriented. And it's wonderful to see him directly, the way he communicates with them and gets the best performance. We were like connected on the hip on the stage. He's leaning over on my notes, making his notes on top of mine. So it was, you get very intimate with the creativity on this show. And it was the same thing with working with Pietro. And I wanted to mention the ADR was so important. As Andy knows, we were fitting that in and it had to be authentic. Authenticity was so important to Michael all the way through. You heard Tony talk about the cars and getting that specifically correct and the sound correct. Well, the dialogue was the Italian, the feel of Italy was so important as well. So the decision was made to make sure it was an all Italian group, not only all Italian, but Northern Italian specifically. We had one gentleman who is from Modena, another gentleman from a town just north of Modena to make sure the accent was as regional as possible. Hired Dina Marone, who came on, who's also a personal friend and is very much in touch with the Italian community, voiceover community in Los Angeles. So we got a great group and made sure that Italian was as authentic as possible throughout. The pit crews, to make sure they were correct. I was put in touch with a gentleman who advised Michael on those scenes, the time period, who was a pit crew member himself. And we would send him all the clips of those pit scenes to make sure that he could advise us and wrote script of the lines that were necessary, what the pit crew would be saying at that time in Italian, that I could give to the group to make sure we had the proper lines in Italian with the right accents, with the right racing protocols, which is very important, especially in Italian culture with that type of thing. There's a hierarchy with the way anything is going to work. And the pit crew certainly had that. So we made sure those were correct.
I feel like I know one thing. I don't know Italian and I don't know cars. And I would not be the one to work on a picture like this. I feel like you guys, after working on a picture like this, you come out knowing a little bit more about a little bit of everything, especially when it comes to cars and maybe Italian culture and speech. Bernard, thank you so much. That was some wonderful backstory that is really helpful to understand. Lee, take it away. Take us home.
Speaking of the Italian connection, Bernard and I both, I'm a citizen, married to I was married to an Italian woman for 25 years, spent a lot of time there. Bernard has spent a bunch of time in his life over there. So, and in fact, in my case, it was Northern Italian connection. So even on the set, I would, you know, bring up to the script supervisor and get it in Michael's ear that sometimes syntax is all that took place. I mean, there was a great line from Adelgisa, and we did it multiple times. And I brought up the fact that it's a joke. It's a comic moment following another scene, you know, which is the opening where we see Laura and Enzo, and she's got this line, and the syntax was, even though the pronunciation was correct, I felt that the audience was never going to get the joke. Because the word, it was the cadence of those words put together, spoken by an Italian speaking English, and it was what Bernard was talking about. That it literally is sometimes, that's where, you know, your magic has to take place, because then you have to create that syntax and that cadence that wasn't there in the performance. But on the bigger picture, it goes back to a conversation that we had earlier that Andy had commented on. Is that sometimes it's in the script, but it doesn't wind up in the final film. In this case, the script was wonderful. When I read it, it was like, you know, first of all, the script's been around for, I mean, like I said, the project's been around with Michael for nearly 3 decades. This script, as far as I know, goes back at least 15, if not more, years. And Michael's had that script for all this time. So, you know, Michael shows up on the set having done incredible work in terms of all the details, how we refer to that book of notes that he brings to set as the Bible. And there's always been the Bible. It's a tome. And in this particular case, I think one of the most satisfying things about working on the film is that Michael knew what the final film was. He knew from the script how he was going to direct it. And it's so the questions that you were bringing up of, well, it's there on the page, but how's it going to turn out? In this particular case, I have to say it is truly that one singular experience for me where I read it. Michael knew it so much inside out that he got every ounce out of the performances and all the rest of the technical support from all the collaborating teams that and I've done now, almost 30 years with Michael. This is by far my favorite experience in terms of the end result. I'm so proud to have been part of the project. I think everyone's work, you know, Michael always brings excellence out in terms of his supporting group. But I just think everybody, it was a collaborative environment that I think was unequaled in my experience with Michael. And that had, you know, went all the way back to the set. I mean, I was working with Pietro much more. I mean, I always work with the editor on the set, but this was different because there were all these things that had to be discussed and people always had to come up to a consensus on being on the same page. How are we going to handle this? So there was complications and there was solutions and compromises and concession that literally followed the film from the first day on set until they finally, did the final QC.
Wow, I would love to spend more time talking about this, but I feel like we covered so many great aspects of collaboration among departments, collaboration with directors, and also just the takeaway of, you know, sound as a storytelling tool, that if a director has it on the page or is thinking about how it can show up in the edit, there's opportunities just to transport audiences. And that's what this film did for me. You know, I was locked in, especially as we got to that final race, and I feel like audiences, go check this film out in theaters. This is one to every film should be seen in a theater, but this one for sure, just because from what he does with the camera through all the sound. Yeah, congratulations, you guys. Really wonderful job, and appreciative of your guys' time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.